Good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2019, and the time is 9:03 a.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha Von Imhoff, and I'm joined today by Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Schauer, Senator Hoffman, and Senator Machicki. Both Senator Bishop and Wilikowski are excused. We do have a quorum to do business. Today's agenda is education data analysis presented by Mark Foster, Public Policy Analyst. So I invited Mr. Foster here because, to me, education is one of the most important departments that we have in our state. For the past couple years, our office has been looking at the effectiveness of state dollars spent in any and all departments. Because while state revenues are decreasing, the costs are increasing, and our office felt that it was important to study the largest departments, healthcare and education. Specifically, as we evaluate and work the budget, the legislature is looking at the impact of its dollars invested and evaluating the best bang for our buck, if you will. And education has always been a passion of mine. I served on the Anchor School Board for a term because I believe a good education is one of the essential components of a successful community and ultimately a productive and healthy state. So together with economist Jonathan King last year, we took a deep dive into academic performance data, trying to remove the effects of poverty measured as economic disadvantage, to see if we could identify the high-performing schools who are exceeding expected performance. We contacted those superintendents and asked them what their secret sauce was. We then hope to focus on those particular schools, find out what they're doing right, and then we can learn something from them and apply it to potentially other schools. As you will see in this presentation, after considering the effects of economic impacts, we found that not all schools perform equal. Not all schools do the same things with their funding. Some perform better than others. So what makes a difference? When we look closely at schools that have similar poverty levels, the difference appears to be class size. And when we talk to superintendents and principals, the quality of teacher also makes a difference. And early literacy rises to the top as well. And when we look at national data, we see the same trends. So the question is how can Alaska focus its limited dollars by investing in targeted and specific areas to achieve the most in academic experience achievement? So today I'd like to introduce Mark Foster, former CFO of the Anchor School District and longtime public policy analyst, to help present the findings of our study into what works in Alaska and where we need to focus our investments going forward to ensure that all students in Alaska get the support they need to make a year of progress for every year of school, as well as be prepared for success in life in whatever they endeavor. So thank you. Mr. Foster, please introduce yourself. And before I apologize, I jumped in. We have President Giesel joining us, Majority Leader Senator Costello, Senator Stevens, and Senator Birch. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to join you here today and share one of the passions that I've had since joining the K-12 group as the CFO at the Anchorage School District, to look at how well we're doing with our investments and to look at that at a statewide perspective. We're going to look at test scores. We're going to dive into how those test scores vary by poverty. We're going to peel back how they impact growth and proficiency of our students. Identify the schools that are delivering superior performance in light of the headwinds that they have. Review what we've learned from those superintendent interviews about what works. Confirm that against national research that's emerging with big data sets. And summarize with recommendations for Alaska on where we should focus our investment. Our disclosures in the packet so you can understand the background and some of the issues and background I have. Also note that I graduated from Lathrop High School in 1979, so I am indeed a product of the Alaska school system during the pipeline era, if you will, and where we double shifted. So I'm quite familiar with some of those early years. And a couple of caveats. A lot of the information we're going to look at today are test scores, and recognize that those test scores are but one measure of how well our students are doing, and they are modestly correlated with success in life. And it's also useful to remember that the research today suggests many of the other skills that we teach in school, many of the social skills and persistence and grit and other of those skills are more tightly correlated with success in life. So the test scores are indicative, but they are not certainly the only thing that we would look at to assess how well we're doing, but they are the data that we do have available to us today. I'm going to look at the National Assessment of Education Progress, frequently referred to as the NAEP scores. We'll look at some of the PEAKS scores as well and show you some maps by school around the state. And one thing that I like to emphasize in the work that I do is let's look at progress over time. So you'll see the presentation on many of the charts and graphs and analysis that we do today. We'll be looking at the growth in students' achievement on these tests from the fourth to the eighth grade. Rather than looking at a snapshot at one point in time, I want to see how students grow over time to see what value the school system is adding to their proficiency. When we look at NAEP scores in reading, I want to look at the scale score and how many points do the students grow from the fourth to the eighth grade, from that group of fourth graders in 2013 to the group of eighth graders in 2017 for all of the 50 states and the Department of Defense schools, and compare that against where they are at on the eighth grade reading scale score. Alaska, as you'll see from this chart, starts from a low base, but has historically provided high growth on the scale scores. Despite our challenges, we are quite competitive across Alaska compared to other states at how well we grow our reading between the fourth and the eighth grade in the NAEP scores. Clearly, we want to head toward a higher base and higher growth, but I think it's useful to acknowledge where we're starting from, and that is a relatively high growth base. The other thing I would note is that when you go back in time and look at this pattern, it's persisted over the last 15, 16 years for which we have data. Alaska tends to be one of the leading states in growth. The other states in that top list tend to be Idaho, California and Arizona, and New Mexico. From time to time, people will suggest, well, if we start from a low base, we have nowhere to go but up. That's an interesting proposition. If you look at the data, you'll see that, in fact, high growers can also grow high, and there's no support for the notion that just because you start low, you'll go high. In fact, that quadrant is relatively underpopulated compared to the others. So I would submit to you that the high growth quadrant is one that we are in, and it's one that we should subscribe to stay in terms of staying in the high growth zone. Math.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Foster, for being here and touching on a very important subject, because several of us here at the table have very small children. But as we look at this graph that you have in front of us, I see it's about reading. What about some, and there's growth in reading. I'm glad to hear that. But what about the other aspects or the other issues that we teach in school as well, which is mainly had to do with mathematics or arithmetic? and even writing for that matter. Do you have scores for that as well?
We do. The next one will be math.
I'm sorry. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Similar presentation here on the math test from NAEP, again, 2013 to 17. And our story here is not as positive. Alaska's in the low base and low growth zone and has a lot of room for improvement. And I think math remains a challenge when I look both at the aggregate data in Alaska and across district by district. From the fourth to the eighth grade, we are not doing a substantial job of lifting compared to what we should be able to do. And I think we'll find that there's lots of opportunity for improvement, and want to encourage everyone to sort of redouble their focus in that area as they look across what, what we're doing and what we could be doing better.
So I'll just interject. What we found in some of our research was with reading and language arts, there are outside influences beyond the teacher, such as trips to the museum, plays, theater, reading in the home, things of that nature. Math is a lot more difficult. Oftentimes your parents don't teach you math. They have less of an influence on math. That seems to be more of a specialty subject, and the teacher becomes the sole provider of math concepts. And then what we found is that this is where the grit comes in to do the memorization and the practice again and again and again to understand the math. And so those two, there seems to be a link between math and grit and teacher. And there is a there's a lot of research in this area, and it's one thing that we should think about. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On these two areas of education, math and reading, the state of Alaska used to be under the state-operated school system where we were up here and said to school districts, this is what you need to accomplish. That wasn't very an effective method, and there was a bill, Senate Bill 35, that changed the state operating school systems to the system that we have today, where we gave school districts the authority to set curricula and work from the bottom up, and that system seems to be working well, and I'm wondering what you thought of those two systems, the state-operated school system where we at the top level say this is what needs to be done, or is it more effective to work with school boards and let them work the system? I think Senator Stevens on Monday talked of special orders about the effectiveness of the schools in Alaska. We're above the standard, and I wonder if you might comment upon that since we are looking at these two pages 5 and 6.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I would welcome the opportunity to address that when I look at the map of how each school is doing on our test score, so I can highlight where I think it's working and highlight some areas where I think we still have challenges. And so I think the system we have continues to have challenges, and so we have to figure out how to make it better.
Thank you.
Senator Machiki has a question.
Yeah, specifically on this slide and the reading slide, what is the significance of the arrow? Is this just a hope for the future, or is it a trend in that direction?
It's the aspirational goal to move into the high quadrant.
Okay.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Foster. We're going to take a quick at ease. Okay, wait. Oh,
there we go.
Do we have it? Okay,
all right.
Oh, now we go way too far. Way too far. Okay, I guess it is page 8. Okay, all right, we'll go with page 8. All right.
I were on the buffer, my apologies.
Oh, now we go back to the beginning.
Next one. Okay. Here we switch to the PEAKS test 2017-2018. We're looking here at fourth grade reading scores across the state of Alaska plotted by school. The size of the plot are the number of students who took the test. And because the sort of Anchorage Matsu area is really crowded, we blew up the Anchorage district there so you could see it in a little more detail. In future presentations, I expect to expand the Kenai, the Matsu, Anchorage, and Fairbanks so you can see those local schools in greater detail and get better resolution to see individual schools. On the map, when you go live in Tableau, you can actually go with your cursor over individual schools and see the results in this format. Allow me to highlight a few of the challenges and opportunities. I want to highlight Unalakleet there in green as a school that continues to provide superior results in early reading. You'll see Kenny Lake also does well right there. And you'll find there's sort of these many hidden gems on Kodiak. And then you'll see the pattern in Southeast as is mostly green with a few reds. And you'll see South Central. What are we really looking at, in part, is about half of the variation is driven by poverty. But these are the test scores, and it shows us where we are not lifting up our students to get to a proficient level and deliver on the promise of an education. Now, the next slide is going to be the eighth grade. It will be the same map, and as you know, that will be a different set of schools. But when you look at the screen, you can also see the pattern emerge of where fourth to eighth grade reading improves and places where it doesn't. A lot of similarities, but you'll note there's some more green in areas that you didn't see before, including a little more green in Southeast, more green in Kodiak, and indeed along the rail belt, but there's still persistent red, whether you're in the lower income neighborhoods of Anchorage or around the state. I'll pause for any questions.
Coach Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yeah, looking at Southeast, I guess when I first look at this map, it would appear that it's rural and urban and predominantly potentially native communities and non-native, but I don't think that's correct. If you look on Prince of Wales, which is a lower southeast, lower end of Southeast on the left, there's clearly red dots that are non-native communities. And also I've noticed on the Cake, which is a predominantly native village I have, they are green in fourth grade English, and then it turns to red in eighth grade English. And that would be the center of Southeast, that red dot in the center of Southeast. The red dot on the middle of Southeast, but on the northern, there's two red dots together. The northern one's Angoon, the southern one is Cake. So, Madam Chairman, on these, this is for year 17-18, would these be similar if we went, you know, 2 years before that and or 5 years before that, or do we just grab the you know, that particular year?
So I'll answer quickly, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Foster. Keep in mind that the state of Alaska used to have the SBAs, student-based assessments. Then it changed, and I don't recall the date, maybe 2014, to another test. And in 2016, I don't believe we tested at all because I believe that there was a glitch in the delivery of the test. So 2017 is the first time I believe that we had peak testing. So we have 2017, 2018, and they're testing students as we speak this week for 2019, and those scores generally are available to the public in the fall. So we have these scores. We also have something called MAP scores that Mr. Foster can discuss, and those are tests that are done periodically through the year. Those are also data that we can use to incorporate in here. And then, of course, this is not NAEP, which we had talked about just before. These are statewide tests. So, Mr. Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would offer that the state tests that are available are the ones that we've plotted. Going to the question, do we have persistent patterns over time? If I try to track back to prior test scores on some of the communities where I have familiarity, I would offer that patterns tend to be persistent. Communities with high support for their education and their students tend to have patterns of high performance over time. I would offer up Skagway as a classic example of that as you look across time periods and look at other test scores and match them up to this most recent data. But we don't have a rich, broad data set across time. It's really kind of bootstrapping different data sources together and then attempting to validate whether the samples are reasonably robust so you can make a comparison. But I would offer there does appear to be some persistence over time for those communities that are doing well.
Senator Stedman, follow up?
Yeah, just a quick question on the lower right, where Ketchikan is, there's an orange dot inside a green one, and there's a red one in the green one. There's Metlakatla down there next to Ketchikan. But is that little red dot a separate school within the Ketchikan district, or do you?
Each dot is a separate school. That's correct.
So is that Saxton?
I'd have to go back and drill down and look to verify.
Okay.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foster, as I look at this one here compared to the other one, it looks like Unalakleet has gone down as far as the eighth grade versus the other. But the one that's more impressive is the one, looks like Unalaska and it's either Chignik or Sand Point have both gone to green. What has been the reason for that?
The teachers have helped the students grow. And they've gained proficiency relative to where they were in the fourth grade. So it's reflecting really what we see in the NAEP score.
I see.
Is they're growing over time, and enough of them are becoming proficient. They've gone from the red through the neutral zone into the green so that more than half of them are proficient.
So teachers are the secret, or one of the secrets?
One of the secrets that the superintendents allude to in the interviews we'll talk about here in a minute.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
So we need to be mindful of the variation in test scores frequently. When I look across both Alaska and U.S. data sets, around half of the variation in test scores tend to reflect poverty and poverty-related factors in households and in neighborhoods. And it's the combination of those two that tend to be a significant factor in test scores. So when we want to look at what's effective in teaching and in schools, we really want to measure the difference between how well the students are doing and how well you would expect them to do given those headwinds of poverty. And so the Gates Foundation, when they examined this 2014, concluded that the best way to begin to measure a school and a teacher's contribution is the difference between where those kids start and where they move them every year and how proficient they are relative to where you would expect them to be given their particular headwinds from poverty. So our goal, if we're really focused, is how do we help all those children learn and grow, regardless of where they start, recognizing that we aspire to have all of them become proficient as soon as we can get them there.
Senator Hoffman has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having traveled extensively throughout Alaska, I think I've been to probably 200 communities in the state of Alaska and been to many of the schools, particularly in my district. And I would agree that high levels of unemployment, poverty, and parental involvement are key factors in a student's education. But throughout my travels, talking to school boards and others, another factor that rises to the top is teacher retention or turnover. And in the last 10 years, the turnover rate in rural Alaska has become astonishing. And from that perspective, I think I don't know if it is higher or lower as it relates to this slide, but I know it is a key factor. If you are out there, I was talking to one of the LKSD people today, and many of the students ask near the end of the school year, they ask their teachers, are you coming back? And the continuity isn't there. When you are a teacher and you don't anticipate staying there, I think that has a direct correlation on how committed you are to educating those students. So although this is an important factor, I would say the problems of teacher retention and all of the things associated with that, when you're hiring teachers from Boston or from back east or wherever the school districts go and they come in, I've heard stories of teachers getting off planes and turning around and getting back on them in rural Alaska. But housing is a factor and teacher retention. But the fact that we have such high turnovers in rural areas of the state, I think is a major contributing factor.
Senator Michiki.
Thank you. Just wondering, and it's probably not a part of your study, but if you look at some of the areas, I can speak for part of the areas of the Kenai Peninsula where poverty is certainly a factor, but there are the community has come together to provide after-school programs that include homework help and STEM programs and things like that. Boys and Girls Club is in Nikiski, Kenai, Soldotna, Kasilof, and Seward, and those areas consistently test higher. Just wondering if you've evaluated some other factors in higher poverty areas that sort of break the mold of that poverty-related challenge.
Yes, is the short answer, and it's coming up.
I do want to interject, though, just to respond to Senator Hoffman's. You're absolutely right. I think the question is how to reverse that trend. Is it housing? Is it broadband for folks to connect to one another? Is it community reception? Is it access to activities? I mean, the question remains, have we done an exit interviews with folks? Is there a compiling of evidence of what the factors are? I don't know if ICER has studied that. Is there a way then, once we get that data, to actually address it? Is it finding Alaskans based in the community, like the dental health therapists, to go back to their region and provide service? Maybe that's it. Maybe we need another Herb Schroeder that over 20 years goes out and finds students in these smallest communities in Alaska and teaches them how to be engineers to help them with the water system so kids can go back with water systems and energy systems and so forth and live in their communities. It takes a cooperation and long-term thinker to convene stakeholders to come up with a plan and then fund it and then stick with it for decades.
Or is it teaching your own that they become educators and they live in those communities?
There is that, Senator Hoffman, and that was what I brought up with Mr. Herb Schroeder, is that he's been successful in galvanizing a whole generation of engineers. Thank you. Mr. Foster?
The pattern in Alaska is similar to the pattern in the United States. On the left, you'll see a map of the percentage of school-aged children in families in poverty by school district. On the right, you'll see the average test scores by school district in grades 3 through 8 for a time period just slightly before those poverty scores. You'll see again, poverty is the primary driver of differences in test scores across the United States as it is in Alaska. It's quite striking when you look across the patterns that we find, and it's easily around half of the difference in the scores. So you want to be mindful of that when we're comparing raw scores. We want to acknowledge that there's a gap. We also want to acknowledge there are significant headwinds in raising our children and getting them to high levels of proficiency. When we look at test scores against percentage economically disadvantaged in English language arts and math, fourth and eighth grade, and plot up each of the schools that we have in Alaska, you'll see the pattern is pretty consistent. In the elementary schools, you'll see there are more dots, there are fewer schools when we get to the eighth grade, but there's still a lot of dispersion even around the general pattern following poverty. So, as some of the comments today have suggested, there are schools that are doing quite well, even relative to the headwinds of poverty, and those were the ones that we followed up with in our study to figure out what do you do that makes the difference? What's the secret sauce, if you will? You'll see in your packet some of those places that are doing well relative to that pattern. And they're from all across Alaska, Southeast, the Rail Belt, and rural Alaska. And so those were the schools and the superintendents in those districts that we said, all right, what is it that's making the difference? And you'll see I've got fourth and eighth grade, both math and English language arts, so you can see a sample of the schools that are doing well. The other thing we've done is to show you on page 19 in English language arts an example of measuring effective teaching using the Gates Foundation model. And what it does is it says, all right, how far are the students growing in percentage proficiency? How many more students are becoming proficient from the 7th to the 8th grade in English language arts? And how well are they doing relative to what you would expect based on their poverty? So who's doing above the poverty line and who's growing their students? And it wouldn't surprise you to learn that some of the high flyers are those who have switched gears and are looking at vocational and technical education in those middle school years and preparing folks for jobs rather than a strictly academic program. And as it turns out, the academic results associated with those programs are high and quite impressive. So I think one of our challenges is how do we replicate that success?
So I'd like to pause here, and I believe one of Senator Hoffman's districts, Lower Yukon, is partnering with the Anchorage School District. It was in the paper recently, and Lower Yukon purchased a hotel on Lake Hood to send students into Anchorage for I believe, a quarter at a time to participate in classes, mainly, I think, at King Career Center in Anchorage. This is for the broader experience to learn vocational classes, because we have the King Career Center here, and it's a very robust school here in Anchorage. And so this is a pilot program. I believe it's going to start next fall. And I think there are many districts that are eyeing the collaboration and to see how it works. King Career Center also did switch to a full-time school. It used to be a part-time school, so kids could leave their neighborhood high school for one or two or three classes a day. And now, with this kind of data and this kind of trend, King Career is a full-time school, so you can be enrolled in King Career all day and take your full courses necessary to graduate from high school, math, language arts, all of it. What we're finding here, or one of the takeaways, is teaching, it's one thing to teach a curriculum, it's another thing on how you teach the curriculum that's culturally relevant, that's engaging to the kids, that's stimulating and exciting and interesting to students. And there seems to be a hook in the vocational technical schools, students who want to use their hands, students who want to be more tactile. It's a real game changer. Some of this data that we're, I wouldn't call it game changer, I suppose. I think a lot of anecdotal people have known this, but now that we're putting the data to it, we're seeing it a little bit more plainly. So teachers who engage students with the outdoors, building things, and that's why you have the rise of STREAM academies, STR, science, technology, research, and art, and math. So those are my thoughts. Senator Machicki.
Thank you. And a few slides back, you don't need to go back, but I noticed my two of my daughters have gone to charter schools. It is not a cross-section of the school district. It's clearly, and you have Aurora Borealis in here, very low poverty rate, very high performing. For another daughter, and this is relevant, that goes to a general elementary school on the Kenai Peninsula, a lot of their time is spent on many other issues not related to educating kids. They just have the, it is a cross-section. There are a lot of behavioral issues and other things that get in the way of learning every day. My point is there a high flyer of a general population school that we can look to as an example that is sort of providing all of those best practice elements in a larger, again, cross-sectional general population school where we can learn from what they're doing right and perhaps help other schools with that success?
I would direct you through the chair, Senator Machicki, I would direct you to page 16. And you'll look in the parentheses, that's the number of students tested. And anyone in that green, and when you get into numbers above 20, you're starting to typically get into schools with a little more variety of in terms of their populations. But clearly, we're already getting into the 40% percentage economically disadvantaged range. And you'll see Mirror Lake with 198 being tested is a large program in sort of the north end of the Eagle River area, and it's doing quite well relative to what you would expect, and it has a fairly diverse population. Others, you know, are more diverse as you go through. So there's clearly progress against the headwinds of those challenges. But I would also highlight that even Borealis, Aurora Borealis Charter and Fronteras Charter are doing better than we would expect, even with low poverty. So I want to commend the results that they're getting there as well.
I also want to point out, though, actually, if you can go back to slide 17, you'll see in Anchorage, Baxter and Clatt. Clatt is in my district. Baxter was similar to where I grew up. And with 66 and 71 students, that's a pretty big sample size. And they are exceeding expectations. But it's also important to note that you're looking at fourth grade. What's interesting to look at is the tests for the peaks begin in third grade and go through 10th grade. So for elementary schools such as Clatt and Baxter, it's important to start looking at third grade and isolate it, and then fourth grade and fifth and sixth. And when you start doing the Gates effect of teaching with the cross chart, you will see the effects of individual teachers or a series of teachers if it's a large enough school to go from fourth grade to fifth grade to sixth grade. And that's where you're beginning to see trends. You can start, and then you look at 2018, 2019, and that's where the data becomes interesting because you can see trends over time, and you can see how schools are doing overall, and where there are strengths and weaknesses, challenges within the school. So again, we're just looking at 1 year, one grade. The key is to start looking at years over time and growth from one grade to the next. Chair Stedman.
Yeah, just looking at that. If we go back to that slide, maybe 17. Or, you got your formulas on the right-hand side, but maybe you can talk a little bit about your formulas and the correlation. Your squared numbers are correlation squared, but or seem low. If you can address that a little bit.
Senator Stedman, through the chair. As we get to smaller sample sizes relative to the state as a whole, we tend to see more dispersion in the numbers. And so as I get down into sort of smaller and smaller samples, whether it's southeast relative to the state of Alaska or the rail belt, we do tend to see more dispersion in the data.
Follow up?
Yeah, Madam Chairman, I think it'd be nice for us to be able to have these charts reprinted so we can take a look at, like, for instance, for my area, southeast, and I'm sure everybody else has their own area, I'd like to be able to identify all my schools. I'm sure you have that, and that would be probably easy to do. And
well, rather than printing it, we're actually hoping to have it interactive, and so we are starting the process today to get the data from Tableau, and we'd like to publish it possibly with the Senate Finance website, and that way it will be open to anybody who wants to look at a particular school, a particular region, and whatever third through 10th. Senator Stedman?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just thinking of the previous questions and issues Senator Hoffman brought up, you know, the longevity of teachers, and I think that's a huge factor. The kids building relationships with their teachers. And the other thing, I, you know, just thinking back when I grew up, if, you know, if they're teaching you math and your parents either don't have algebra or are so rusty on algebra, they forgot how algebra works. And when you start getting into, you know, some of the more advanced stuff, and most likely with English arts too, language arts, it's more difficult if your parents can't help you. And I noticed that with my own daughter growing up. Her friends were their parents couldn't help them, versus my daughter were kept up with her to halfway through college. It makes a big difference when your parents can have the willingness and the ability to help when the more advanced issues.
Senator Machicki.
Just, if you can go back. The chair probably would. 17. The trend line is, I assume that's the mean. So the blue is the mean for rural, the orange is for southeast, and the gray is for The rail belt?
That's correct.
That is correct, okay. And just to touch on what Senator Steadman just said, the difference between, I will tell you that my kids have all had the same teachers, and as Lucy gets into the next grade, they still have our cell phone in their phone. They know that we leave for 3 months out of the year to come down here. They know the family stuff. I mean, when you think about those relationships over essentially an entire generation of kids versus seeing a teacher that's there for a year or so, I mean, that is amazingly important, and I don't know how you fix that. I know we're going to get to that a little later on some of those impacts, but I mean, I don't that instability is very difficult to overcome. So I know we're going to talk about the gaps, but is there a way to overlay something over those challenged districts that could compensate for some of that instability?
Is that a rhetorical question, or
no? Because I know I go back to the sort of often private sector supported after school programs that provide a layer of instability that are available in many parts around the state. But I'm just wondering if that's, I don't think the districts can provide all. Sometimes I think we have to look at other factors that can help provide some of that stability. So that is the question: is that something that you evaluated?
Mr. Foster.
Thank you, Senator Maticki, through the chair. The short answer is yes. That was certainly part of the conversation with the superintendents that we talked to about what's driving your superior results and what are the challenges that you face. And as you'll note on page 22 in the rural considerations, what theme comes through again and again and again are the themes that we've had discussed here today. Rural districts with high teacher turnover rates have a lot of challenges at not just test scores, but graduation rates and many of the factors to prepare kids for success in life. That is a fundamental challenge we face, and we faced it for decades.
Follow up.
Senator Maticki.
If you separate, I mean, the trend line, the mean, is significantly separated when you look at rail belt versus even southeast and then, of course, rural. And so we deal with a lot with the public who say we're number 49 in the country, by golly, you know, money has nothing to do with, okay, whether or not that's true. If you evaluate, what if you break out rail belt? How does it compete nationally? And if you break out southeast, how does that compete nationally? Because I assume that we're looking at an average or a mean across the entire state. How does the rail belt compete nationally with test scores? Do you know the answer to that?
We have some preliminary maps, and we look forward to sharing those once we double check them. But I would offer that Southeast and the Rail Belt, given their poverty, English language learners, and special ed sort of prevalence, those figures, in a one-factor, two-factor, three-factor model, appear to be competitive with the U.S. in comparable sort of conditions.
Senator Schauer, I saw that your hand was up.
I did. Thanks, Madam Chair. First question, and just you may, I don't see it in the slides here, but do you have historic data that goes back, you know, 2000, 1990, 1980, et cetera, that's comparative? And is that something you could talk to see? Because my question really relates to trends. How were we doing in the past? Has something changed dramatically? And could you tie those together that would show trend up or down and what we might have done that caused this as a causal factor? So have you looked back in historic data?
Looked at the NAEP data, given its relative stability as a test. The state tests, I haven't been able to bootstrap back because of the variation in the standards over time. Some folks have attempted to bootstrap the ACT and SAT tests back over time, but the sample size is there, and who tests in any given year tend to throw that off. Our sample sizes in Alaska are relatively small. In any given year, even a difference of a few dozen can really swing that. And we had an example in Anchorage where we ran an experiment where we doubled the number of kids in an AP English test and had significantly different results, even though we wouldn't have expected that. So I think it's really challenging to get a reliable backcast, and I would offer that for all of its limitations, NAEP is probably our best backcast, and it doesn't go back very far.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. I'd love to see if there's data there that would go back. I mean, you may not have it, but that would be interesting to go back for decades and see what has changed in our glide path. Second kind of point or questions, I know we have 54 school districts. Other states have many smaller ones. That's come up consistently, not just as a cost driver, maybe the ability to save, but I wonder, we have a hub and spoke model in some ways in teaching, almost like we have for troopers, whereas Senator Hoffa was mentioned, you have people that are there for a little while and then they're gone. It's hard to have that kind of continuity. If troopers are there for just a little while and they leave, how do you establish that trust long term? And it happens with our teachers. And I know things have been mentioned like housing and internet connectivity and other types of things, but I wonder if, as I'm listening, because there's, you know, a lot of data, but we haven't really got many of the solutions yet. I hope we're going to go there looking at it. But are there things like reducing the school district sizes where we have less school districts and more resources available to have teachers that didn't have to do such a hub-and-spoke model, or something that would make it, as the points have been made, where they have the ability to be there longer? Because obviously we need to solve, so we have problems being pointed out, but we need to solve them. So what are some of the solutions? And I think maybe you're going to get to that, but I think that's one of our major drivers here is how do you solve that, for lack of a better term, a hub and spoke type model with teachers, just like troopers, because we need them to stay. They need to be there. So is that something you're going to discuss? Long point to get to the question, sorry.
Yes, we have an outline at the end on the recommendations that we can talk to that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You spoke on it earlier, and maybe you have a slide that covers it, but number three of your three points at the beginning about was early literacy. My question to you is that how important is the pre-K programs that are out there, whether it's Head Start or otherwise, that allows the children to go ahead and try and get a head start before they get to grade school? Can you comment? You can either comment on that now or later, whenever it's appropriate for your presentation. And partly has to do with that we constantly are back and forth on trying to fund it.
With respect to pre-K, Senator, through the chair, I would offer that pre-K can, in high-quality programs, be very effective at helping children, particularly from challenged homes and challenged neighborhoods and challenged communities, build a foundation. And so we see, I think, if you look at the data, pretty good results in those areas. There are other sort of reviews of the data that suggest the results aren't robust over time, or in the really long-term studies that in fact pre-K does help kids, not just on test scores, but later on when they go to get jobs and they go to basically raise families. It turns out there's some correlations there when you look at the really long data sets that have been examined. So I do think there's value, and I think it's concentrated value, particularly for those communities where the children have challenges.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we're, just for the listening audience, we are on slide 22, and you can take it from there. Thank you.
I would like to highlight sort of the rural and then the Rail Belt Southeast considerations. Clearly, there's agreement that we need effective teachers in small class sizes when I look at both sort of sets of responses. The challenge we're finding as I look across the data and the interviews is what's been highlighted here today, is it is very hard to attract, retain effective teachers in many of the communities. What are some of the reasons for that? Some of it's price, Some of it are related to other factors in those communities. And I think the challenge we have is how to bring together the groups who have an interest in making sure those students, all of our students, have an equal opportunity to a quality education. And we're not doing it today. The test results and other results suggest to me that we have a lot of room for improvement. And one of the places we need to focus is on teachers and making sure that they're not only well prepared, but they're effective in a wide range of community settings. And we haven't done that very well, and I'm afraid we've been at it for a few decades, and it's time to take a step back and go, what can we do different? Just a few notes. The national data, the meta-analysis by John Hattie, and additional research from Raj Chetty at Harvard support the conclusions that the superintendents here have. We offer that up in part because there are a lot of vigorous debates among superintendents and among teachers and principals and school boards about what works and what matters. And frequently those debates are quite vigorous and over relatively smaller issue. The bigger issue is how do we get effective teachers in small class sizes so that all the children have an opportunity to learn. We've got to focus there and build from that base. And let me emphasize, within the sort of the education community, class size is frequently a source of debate about whether it's important or not. Allow me to offer that recent research from large data sets, page 26, Raj Chetty, and these are millions of records across the United States, and he's also looked at international data, that in fact, a good teacher, a high impact teacher, can make a significant difference in just a few school years across all of their students. So reducing class size in primary school by hiring more teachers can have large returns. But those teachers have to be high impact teachers. And that's our challenge. It's not just any one of these items. It's all of them together that are required to make the difference. So, what does a successful partnership look like? It has to be both the state and the local community focusing on all of the students making at least a year's progress.
So I just want to pause there. Can you go back, thank you, Mr. Foster, to 29? Or actually, if you don't mind, you have a question too. Okay, if we could go back to actually 27, please. So quickly, you made a comment, but it's all these things together, and you're absolutely right, and that's the difficulty, that's the challenge. But I did want to point out that it's together, Raj Chetty indicated that small class size, which we saw on slide 26, coupled with highly effective teachers together makes the largest impact. And so it's having both together is where we see the largest returns, and I just wanted to point that out. Senator Schauer.
I have two questions. The first one, if you could expand upon your top bullet up there. It says new data shows changing public schools in certain specific ways can have long-term solutions. I don't think we really discussed that yet. Maybe you're going to, or what are those things as we talk about solutions? And then the second question is critical to hire highly effective new teachers. I can't argue with that data, but my question would be, how do you propose to measure what a highly effective teacher is, and how then do we know that we're getting what the quality and what we want from those teachers as far as the money that we're spending? How do we know? So how do you do that?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, With respect to the latter point, we've initiated a dialogue with the Commissioner of Education about how we would go about doing that in a culturally relevant and appropriate way for Alaska to measure what works and what is a highly effective teacher and what can we do to attract and retain those highly effective teachers. I think one of the takeaways from slide 27 is we need to do more to attract and retain so we can keep those teachers, high impact teachers, in the classrooms making a difference for our children. That's where we have to focus our investment. And I think it's particularly relevant at the state level to help make sure that's what's happening so that all the students have an opportunity.
You have a follow-up, Senator Schauer?
Well, could you go back to the first question, though? I think we kind of skipped over that one, which is you said new data show change in public schools in certain specific ways. Is that just these specific ways below that? Is that what that means, or is there more data within that bullet point that we didn't discuss?
If you, yes, Senator Schauer. That particular study set that you'll find, if you chase the source back to the internet, he was looking at teachers, class size, and technology. And so he was trying to evaluate which of those three factors or combinations were the most valuable. And Professor Chetty concluded from that data analysis that the specific ways required small class sizes and effective teachers is the most effective way to make a difference in children's lives.
So it's included.
Chair Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yeah, just going back to the earlier comments about how do you get a teacher effective or not effective, just a teacher, and get them into rural Alaska so they're comfortable and they fit in and they're not viewed as an outsider, regardless if they're sitting in an island in southeast or western Alaska in Bethel or wherever. I'll just use those two as an example, or Senator Olson's area up in Nome. There's definitely cultural differences between those three locations in a suburban area in America with grass yards and concrete sidewalks and grocery stores and all kinds of shopping centers and everything else all around. That's a tough one to get those people out of there to up here to, and then have them relate to our youth or even the communities. So to Senator Hoffman's question is, how do we get Alaskan kids, students, to become teachers and come back? The kids relate to them a lot better, the students. You can see it in just a communication with them. And it doesn't matter if they're sitting in Bethel, they're sitting on Prince of Wales, or in Sitka for that matter. I think that's one of the things that we should kind of keep our eye on when we deal with the university and those programs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Another key factor that I see that's directly attributed to teacher turnover, which hasn't even been discussed here, and that is transient teachers. You know, you have teachers in Anchorage, in Bethel, in Nome, in Sitka, down the peninsula, where those teachers are members of the community. You know, they don't leave that community in the off season. They participate in that community. But when you have 90 to 100% of your teachers leave that community, are transient teachers, so they have no roots there. That, I think, is probably just as a problem in teacher turnover than anything else, because they don't feel like they are a member of the community, and that possibly subconsciously affects the way that they teach. So I would agree with Senator Stedman that the better solution long term is to get and educate local people to become teachers. We did that in 15 years ago when we had a high turnover in healthcare in nurses, and the campus in Bethel started recruiting and educating local people to become nurses, and as a result, we have, I think hundreds of nurses that are staying there and improving the health care, and I think that template can be utilized in changing the education of rural Alaska by focusing in on educating local people as teachers, as was suggested by Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. So we're on slide 29.
Two main points in conclusion. One, success will require a partnership between the state and the local communities. Local community support is absolutely critical. State support for effective teachers and small class sizes and culturally relevant education and early literacy are key components. That's what we're being told, and that's what the data supports. So I would encourage you to target investments in small class sizes, effective teachers, and early literacy, and make sure that we have accountability where every child deserves 1 year of progress for each year of school. And to follow up on Senator Hoffman's comments, I think one of the most promising areas we have for making significant progress in rural Alaska is to learn from the lessons of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, where we focus resources, work with the local communities, and build the capacity for those regions and those villages to make a difference for those kids by having effective teachers in their classrooms. Thank you.
I saw Senator Schauer had a question, and then followed by Co-Chair Stedman.
Two questions. I'll ask them if you can just answer them in order. The first one is, you talked about accountability. Every child deserves 1 year of progress for school or in school. I believe it was Arizona recently instituted a policy for the fourth grade to try to make sure that they made it, because we know that you stop learning to read, you read to learn. And that's a lot of what has been discussed here. So I believe it was well under 1% of the students were held back when they instituted the policy, because one of the concerns, oh my gosh, we're going to hold a bunch of kids back and it's going to destroy their self-esteem, all the kinds of issues, and it ended up being, a little tiny fraction, like 38 out of 100,000. I don't know what the number was, but it was small. And that is something that shows that if you hold them back, that's important. So I agree that each children deserves that 1 year of progress, but would you contend, or would you say that it's worth holding students back to ensure they reach that, versus what has kind of been the no student, no child left behind, we keep moving them no matter what, when we need to make sure they're ready, which can have dramatic impacts down the road? That's question one. And then the second one circles a little bit back to the Commissioner of Education. As you were talking about this, have you considered or discussed a performance-based system with tenure, so that we have student or teachers that we can uphold performance standards? How are we going to ensure we get there if we don't have something in place to make sure that we're able to get the quality teachers that we need and that performance standards are being upheld? So I know two long questions, but really two there. Thank you.
Senator Schauer, for the chair. With respect to holdback policies, the historic research has suggested grade retention policies based on proficiency tend to have negative results over time. And then more recent analysis in education, finance, and policy, the peer review articles there suggest that those grade retention policies tend to fall more on women who don't have a college education. So there's a disproportionate impact on young mothers and their children and their anxiety about their child, whether or not they're getting a good education. And the disproportionate share doesn't help those children. It tends to hurt them. So I would be very cautious, based on the literature that I've seen, about a policy that raises the bar for holding children back in order for them to gain mastery. I think the evidence weighs heavily against a heavy hand. I think the evidence weighs in favor of teachers and parents and administrators talking about particular challenges that the children may have, but they tend to be in their behavior and whether or not they're ready to advance into first and second grade. So the research, in my mind, suggests that if you're going to focus on ready to learn, you focus on whether those kindergartners are really ready to go into the first grade, because you've got pretty good research there that suggests those policies can be effective, because we're really making sure that the social skills are there so you don't have disruptions in classrooms. And so that tends to be effective, whereas holdbacks third and fourth grade in reading proficiency don't appear to be as effective. With respect to performance standards, I think you'll find there's a growing body of evidence around how to measure effective teaching. Raj Chetty, among others, has been an expert witness in court cases that are specifically been designed around the notion that we need to do a better job at identifying high-impact teachers and measuring that and reliably measuring that so that we can deliver high-impact teachers to our students. And they tend to require 3, 4, 5 years of data to make sure that you get reliability. LA Unified School District, the data there is big enough, they think they can do it in 3 years and really identify whether a teacher is effective or not. From all the noise, because you have variation among all the students, are you making an impact for all your students? I think in Alaska, given the sort of the wide variety and the smaller samples, it may take us 3 or 4 years, maybe even 5 years, to be able to really identify who a high-impact teacher is. So it's not a trivial task at all. Otherwise, we would have done it before.
So we have Chair Stedman followed by Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to come back to that earlier comment about the high teacher turnover in rural and semi-rural Alaska, particularly some of the island communities, and I would guess that Western Alaska is very similar. It takes a while to integrate somebody into your community. And when someone shows up for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, that's not long enough. And they may call our little communities cliquey. That's a very common term I heard of the community I grew up in. We didn't see it internally. But clearly you had to be there for a while to be accepted into the community. Sometimes a decade or longer. It takes a while. And if you're from a totally different culture from the States, it's an adjustment, you know, to relate just to the recreational activities and what the students like to do and how they learn. So I just thought I'd mention that because it's something we don't talk about much at the table. But there is a difference, and it takes a while.
Actually, Senator Wilson, followed by Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, schools, education is very, I tell people it's often complex, as just as healthcare. You know, Senator Schauer brought up the whole social promotional issues that happen within the school districts. There's a right to promote just to stay in the same grade, and then there's that on both sides. You know, we have the issues of the low-performing teachers. You have to find a way to sort of out those low-performing teachers, and there's no metrics of accountability for those low-performing teachers. We know often I've heard that we teach from the lowest child. We can go as fast as, I'll quote Senator from Bethel, we can only go as fast as a slow sled dog. And sometimes that teachers feel that way, that they can't continue to go because they have a few students that hold them back in terms of progress. We have a definition of what is a small class size, cultural competency, you know, sort of the relevance of the curriculum that at Titan schools. We have behavioral health issues. We have ACEs, trauma-informed schools. And in Alaska, we have school districts that are single-site schools, and I think half our school districts are at four or less school sites. So with all of this, I mean, there's systems and models. I think you've showed on the earlier side, the DOD, EA schools, that seem to have sort of a mix of kids that come in, and they seem to be doing things right. What are they doing that we're not doing in Alaska? Because I would hate to spend all this time, let's study this. We know what schools in our nation that are similar enough to Alaska or have success, even within our state, that are having success in Alaska. Can those models just be copied and have success here in our state without looking at spending another 3 to 5 years studying this issue, and so we have another generation of kids that won't be able to benefit from those?
Senator Wilson to the chair. The sequence I think that I've outlined here is the sequence I'd recommend to the Senate and to policymakers across the state, and that is understand where we're at here locally, talk to the local subject matter experts and understand what works and what doesn't, and then validate it against sort of that national data or national case studies. But in my experience, if I try and bring a model from outside here, it takes a lot of work to fashion it to make it work here locally. Where I think I've had more success over time is starting with the local model and building on it or discovering that it's broken and then getting the folks in a room who have an interest in fixing it to get together and do that. I offer the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium as an example from my personal experience working in public health in research in that area for a few decades. And particularly, you know, looking at rural sewer and water systems, Indian Health Service predating, and then the Denali Commission, and trying to understand what is happening on the ground in Alaska in each of our communities. Try and understand what the challenge is and why we haven't been able to fix it. What are the roadblocks to getting to a space where we're going to make a difference? And sometimes it's not a simple fix. It's truly a change in governance and letting the local folks be in charge of their fate, but at the same time having an accountability measure that goes with it. I think that's what I've learned from that experience in healthcare. It's certainly the pattern that I see emerging from the research that I've done in K-12, and I would commend it to you. Start with the local knowledge. There are lots of people here locally who know a lot about what they're up against. It's the inertia that they need help with. It's not really the model. It's the inertia, and we need to help them get over those hurdles. Thank you.
So before we go with Senator Machicki, the comment is, I mean, you're spot on, Senator Wilson, and thank you for a response, Mr. Foster. It's what can the state do? As we sit and contemplate the state budget, we can invest in broadband for connecting students and connecting teachers with each other. We can explore tribal compact agreements and whether and how those make sense. We can work together with the university to try to do an aggressive campaign to attract local young people to our university systems to train to become teachers, and absolutely be the conveners of the stakeholders in the different regions to come together and discuss ideas and make a plan. I would note that anything that we do takes a long time, and I'm not suggesting that the planning takes a long time. I think the implementation, you will find the state of Massachusetts has been the top of the NAEP scores for many, many years. They passed their State of Massachusetts Education Reform Act in 1993, and it took them nearly 7 years to implement all 8 components, and then it took probably another decade after that to see the results. So no time like the present to start on these efforts. So that's my thought. So Senator Michikee.
Yeah, that was actually the direction I was going, Madam Chair. I don't think that I have a lot to add. I've been here 6 years. This is my seventh year, and we've been hearing about these issues. There's nothing groundbreaking about the study. I think these are things we knew. I appreciate it being data supported. But that really is the question. Is there a think tank of the right people that understand the issues? And Senator Wilson talked about the ACEs related issues. In some parts of Alaska, it's almost impossible for them to come to school ready to learn because of the challenges they have every day in psychological survival, frankly. So those are the questions I'd like to see us get. Who are the right people? Do we have this isolated think tank that has the right stakeholders? And who is financially capable of contributing today that has not been contributing? And I think that's a very important aspect, because if what you say is true and we take the rail belt and we realize that we're competing nationally in the rail belt, perhaps we don't have the focus in that area, who are the right financial stakeholders? And can we create some public-private partnerships that help in the cost of that? Because I still say that the school district, the school system cannot solve all these problems. It is a partnership that brings those other challenging aspects to the table while delivering the best quality education we can. It's frustrating to not see the progress that we'd like to see, and I think it will take some time, but what I'd like to at least focus on is getting the right people to the right table to have the discussion.
Thank you, Senator Michikee. Hold on here. I believe I had Senator Stedman. Nope. Okay, we have Senator Schauer followed by Senator Olson.
So as part of this is, you know, more teachers and the results, but these are pretty thin findings, and I mean they may be very impactful, but there's not, I was hoping we might see more solutions. It sounds like maybe some are being discussed, being worked on. One of the questions I'd have, back to kind of that hub and spoke model we talked about, it's almost like a two-tiered system, one for the rail belt, one for rural. I know that's not the direction we're going, but it almost sounds like in a way you need something like that, because you have geographical and cultural issues that are different from one area to the next, and we're a big state. That's one of our challenges, right? Have you looked, or has anyone looked around, not just the country, but the world, to find some system that's working that might help these challenges we face, especially when you're looking at two almost separate groups that you're trying to teach, because they're not the same? That's part of our problem. Look at it. We're trying to do different things, and there's cultural differences here as well. So how far have we reached out to find a solution that might help us do better?
Just Senator Schauer, through the chair. When I was at the Anchorage School District, one of the studies that we undertook was to look at international turnarounds, what school systems that had a variety of diverse populations, what did they do to turn around performance, and how long did it take? And inevitably, those models tended to be decentralized, that is to say, they allowed schools and school districts, or the equivalent, to have autonomy with accountability back to the central funding source, whether it was even a Finland model or any of the international models that are known for their high scores. In the end, those were some common themes. So I think that's where I would start if I'm looking at sort of what structural model, what's the fundamental structural driver that's associated with success. It's allowing folks who understand the local challenges, the local community, what do they need to be successful, combined with funders who provide adequate funds and who demand accountability to make sure they're getting a return. I think those are the key components. And then the other thing that we alluded to is it does take time.
We have Senator Olson followed by Senator Wilson.
Mr. Foster, this may be out of your area that you've studied for this particular presentation, but one of the things that alarmed my wife and I when we were dealing with the school district back at home was that they now have progressed into allowing or still prescribing homework, but it's non-graded, which to us meant that you got homework assigned to you, but that it wasn't graded. And in my educational experience, it was the homework that gave me the discipline as well as the ability to go ahead and finish off with the education that I got. But they were saying that there were certain studies related to that issue out there. I was wondering what your thoughts were and where the holes were in those studies that were presented that showed that it made no effect on the graduation rate of high school as well as the ability for them to go on to higher education, college, graduate school, et cetera.
Senator Olson, through the chair. I'd have to concede I have not done an independent research in that particular issue to drill down in it and understand the dynamics. And I'm afraid I, too, suffer from a past where my homework was graded, so I'm biased in that direction as well. But I haven't independently looked at it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm hearing two different things, and maybe it's a combination of both, but you're saying that Alaska is so unique that we can't use other systems that have shown to work around, you know, but at the same time, you're saying that we have studies, we know that, you know, you noted that class sizes, effective teachers, those things work. I mean, human development is still human development around the world. The brain still sort of works in the same way for the most part, and you do have the cultural experiences and do have other issues. I mean, it seems that we can implement certain things. DEED can implement, the Department of Education and Early Development can implement, and they know what works in certain areas. And so what I'd like to know, and so the frustration, so I don't have to be here from the senator from District O for 6 years having the same conversations, this spiraling, death spiral of education, is what can be done sooner than later to help correct this curve of education within our rural system, within the rail belt, and for Alaska, generally speaking, that we can start to look at policies, maybe starting from the next session, that we can start looking at for this session, that we can implement. I mean, Alaska is not so special that it does other items that have been best practices around the world won't work for Alaska. I mean, there are things that we can do that we don't need to, you know, do a stakeholder meeting for another 2 to 3 years. I mean, that's all we seem to do. If we want something to die, we just put it in committee. We study it to death.
Senator Wilson, through the chair. I would offer that there are a lot of lessons that we can import, but if the local community isn't ready, willing, and able to import that lesson, it will be a lot like a teacher who comes and goes. It won't have an impact. So I think in order for us to be successful, we have to prepare the ground. And that means engaging the local communities in a serious and substantial dialogue about what do we need from our schools so that our children will be successful, not only in school but in life, to make sure we've got opportunities for them. And I think you've got to start there. I think the commissioner has done some good work beginning that dialogue, because if I don't start there, I will come and go and I'll be a transient. In order to really build a successful model, I've got to build it from the local community up. And bringing in new ideas can frequently sort of get conversations going, but I have to get buy-in locally. So I think that's our challenge, and it's really frequently getting over local inertia around particular things that people, you know, grew up with or are protecting. And we need to let go of some of that and go, we need to do a better job. How do we do that? But I think we have to start locally.
So just to add on that, Senator Wilson, there are things that we can do sooner rather than later, and that is tying part of educational funding to specific items such as class sizes, as in hiring teachers versus administrators, effective teaching, which means local districts and local teacher unions may have to look at their seniority bumping rules, because in funding, when there's choices to be made, which teacher is allowed to stay and which teacher is let go. And that is material, as we are finding. And that's part of the local community's decisions about how to move forward with that. We can tie funding to accountability measures, as in peak testing over time. Mr. Foster recommended somewhere between 3 and 5 years. That is when trends become more illuminating. So those are conversations that the education committee and that this larger committee can have and how we move forward. Senator Wilson, did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I'll pass.
Senator Hoffman.
Well, let's just look at a small rural Alaska community in my district, say Tuntutuliak. You know, for the most part, it's an isolated community. It probably takes $300, $350 to go round trip between there and Bethel. But a teacher, even from the lower 48, but even from Alaska, from Anchorage maybe, they go out there, they're recruited, they haven't been to that school, they get off the plane and they're brought to their residence on a four-wheeler, because the whole community is interconnected by boardwalks and vehicles aren't there. So they get situated into a small place, and whether they're school housing or on their own, have to sign up for electricity. They don't have any running water. They go to the store for the first time trying to get some basics. Very little, if any, spices, very little fresh produce. A gallon of milk costs $12. So they get situated and they start teaching, and then along comes September. All of the teenage boys get up and leave for 2 weeks to go moose hunting. Throughout the year, they're out with their rifles catching ptarmigan and other things. But that teacher has to live there, and the weekend comes, you know, well, they're not going to go to a movie. They're not going to go out to a restaurant. They are there and have to occupy their time as a teacher and try to fit in culturally to the to that community, as Senator Stedman said. But for the most part, the community goes on with its cultural activities irregardless of what those teachers are doing. And they have to do this for 9 months. Visualize yourself being a teacher going out to Tuntutuliak, getting off and moving into being brought into housing on a four-wheeler and being isolated there, which I probably think many of them feel, for 9 months, because they are paid $35,000 a year and can't afford even to go to Bethel maybe once during that time. And they're looking forward to May, that is the realities that I think many people at this table would find hard to live in, let alone a 25 or 30-year-old individual. They won't have a snow machine to travel around. Those teachers won't. They won't have a four-wheeler. They won't have a boat to go out and enjoy the river in the springtime. So those are the realities. And how do you get a teacher in that situation, let alone an effective teacher, to affect grades? And I think that's the reality in many of the communities that Senator Olson have, and to some extent Senator Stedman has, but Senator Stevens had a daughter that went out to one of my districts, Kalispell, and I'm sure she conveyed to him the drastic differences of trying to teach in rural Alaska, and I'm sure that even for her, as a person growing up on Kodiak, trying to teach in a rural community on the upper reaches of the Kuskokwim in Kalispell were an eye-opener to her, and I'm pretty sure she still remembers how difficult it was to try to get by even during those weekends where there was, you know, one store, the store running out of a lot of commodities, waiting for the mail plane to come in to bring in groceries. Because of weather, maybe not having those mail planes come in for 3 or 4 or 5 days. So that, I think, if you sit back and try to visualize life in a rural community, those people that are living out there, my constituents, they love that lifestyle and live it. And a teacher has to address the cultural shock that Senator Stedman said, and it is a very, very challenging situation.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. That was a great description. Senator Schauer, you held your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to say it. Some people are probably going to flinch when I do, but I know you said poverty is a big driver up front, and this is not meant to, as the budget battle rages on, the lowest income amongst us are affected the greatest by, you know, what comes out of that dividend check. And I'm not here to say that it should be a certain amount. That's not what I'm here to say, other than I think it should not be lost in this body, as some are discussing significant reductions, and even in the other body, like a $500 versus a statutory amount, that's a big impact to people that are poor. And so in this discussion, as you're talking this entire picture, because there's much more to this than just money, I think it shouldn't be lost in the body that whatever we do, the decisions that are made are going to impact the lowest income that are struggling the greatest. And that's why I think it's important and germane to this discussion, because of what you said in this briefing up front of how important that is to the lowest income Alaskans. My question specifically for you, though, is at Mount Edgecombe, which has a high Native population, has done very well. And as we talk about models and things you have looked at, have you looked specifically at Mount Edgecombe and why, with a high Native population, they tend to do very well compared to some of the areas that are struggling? And is there things that we could learn from that or perhaps apply in a different format?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I haven't had a chance to drill down and look at individual schools. What we did was essentially identify the schools and then have a conversation with the superintendents about what was successful and what wasn't. So I don't have an informed opinion about Edgecombe's performance relative to sort of any comparator you might use to see whether they're really above or below your expectations. Given that it's a magnet school, you'd want to make some adjustments in order to assess whether they're really doing better than you would expect or not, given the population that self-selected to go there. So I don't have an insight there.
It would be interesting to look at not only Mount Edgecombe, but Galena, I think Nanana, and I think there's a school in Bethel as well, so there's more than one. But before I turn it to Senator Stedman, I just want to comment. The senator from Bethel talked about fishing and having access to boats. There is a saying that if you give a man a fish through a $3,000 dividend, you feed him for a day or a couple months. You teach a man to fish, and you feed him for a lifetime. Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Yeah, just on the Mount Edgecombe issue, I think we need to be a little careful with Edgecombe. They bring in students from all over Alaska. And for the most part, they're the higher performing students in some of the rural areas, in the most rural areas, into a very closed environment. They're away from their parents, and they're in an old military barracks from World War II. And they go through their classrooms, exercises and stuff, and then they think they're allowed to go home once or maybe twice. a year, I think it's once. And if we compare it to other schools, we'll take Senator Hoffman's, you know, region as an example. He has quite a few students that come to Edgecombe, but it's his better students normally that end up being selected or want to go and end up at Edgecombe. So it, in certain regards, it has a negative impact back in his own district, because some of the students that could help the other students with some of the learning are not there anymore. So we have a little adverse selection issue. But with that being said, the performance of that school is good, and the attitude of the students is markedly different from the other schools in my district. When you talk to the school professionals, there is more discipline within the school. A discipline, and I don't mean by the discipline with the ruler, you know, wrapping the knuckles like they did when I was little. The students are there to learn. And when you go to the other schools, Sitka across the bay or across the channel or Petersburg, Wrangell, Ketchikan, whatever, you get a mixture of all the students in the community. Some of them are a little more rambunctious than others, and some of them, frankly, don't want to learn, and they have, you know, management issues. So Edgecombe, you don't see a lot of that. It's very noticeable when you present to the classes or you're teaching a class at Edgecombe. And if we could instill that in other schools, I think you'd have performance increases. So just want to say, Madam Chairman, just want to be a little bit cognitive of the structure of Edgecombe when you compare it to the other schools. And by the way, a lot of leaders of the state come out of that school. Fortunately, Senator Hoffman and Senator Olson didn't have the opportunity, or I'd be working them over all the time for help. Let's go.
So I think Senator Schauer just wanted to have a very small comment on that.
Very brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree with that. Everything needs to be taken with a grain of salt. My point was only that if we have successful schools, there may be lessons learned that we should be looking at, and you would certainly not maybe take the whole model, but if there's things that are working, especially for the native population, whatever those might be, perhaps we can replicate those in other areas of the state. Maybe there's things we can do better. So I'm not suggesting we take it all, and I hear you loud and clear, Senator Stebbins. I just think that was something we should perhaps look at, because if they are successful in metrics, what could we use that might work somewhere else? That's all. Thank you.
So we have Senator Michicki followed by Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you. For folks that do not know this, the Alaska Native graduation rate in the Kenai Peninsula School District is higher than the general and higher than the non-Alaska Native. So clearly there's not a intellectual challenge. There's nothing like that. It has to do with where folks are going to school and the opportunities that are brought to them. But this is a little bit of an echo chamber. I wish we had other folks at the end of the table we can bounce some of these things off of. But in Senator Stevens' district, which used to be mine, you have two schools, Nikolaevsk and Vasisenka. And the test results are very different. They're culturally, socially similar, very close together, but the test results are very different. I guess what I'm getting at, Madam Chair, is I'd love to understand the correlation of poverty to poorly performing areas. It's poverty can often be circular. It's not because people have less money that the results are different. It's about skill, opportunity, motivation, incentive, vision, and inspiration. Some of the things that those are the real challenges about poverty-stricken areas. I wonder if there's a way to counteract that, and who is looking into those challenges and how we can help support the differences. I mean, in some cases, there's a lack of a role model. And when you make that comparison with rural Alaska, that's a whole different creature. Just a whole different creature. I have no way of understanding that. And those challenges are not comparable than anywhere else in the U.S. So again, you're just hearing a little bit more of my frustration. But I would like to understand the correlation between poverty and a lack of academic performance. I think that is a major question that affects the outcomes in the state of Alaska.
Mr. Foster, did you want to take a stab at that, or is that within your purview?
I would just offer that I think there are a number of folks who are looking at that now in earnest, now that we've had a couple of years of the peak scores, and we're trying to understand what's driving the results, and not at a school level, but at an individual student level, to understand what are the risk factors for those schools, and what are the tailwinds that are making a difference in those children's lives, so we have a better understanding at a student level. Because keep in mind, the presentation today was aggregated at the school level and at a grade level. And I really where the rich data mining is to be had is understanding what makes a difference for each of our students. So that's a sort of another level of analysis. And the best way to get that information is to talk to the high impact teachers to understand what they're doing to make a difference in all of their students' lives, because that's where you really start to see what's making a difference.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. I would just add to help with Senator Machiki is that there are two organizations, the Matsu Health Foundation. We had Elizabeth Ripley here talk about they are single-handedly paying, I think, in 9 pilot schools for a behavioral health therapist to actually sit in the schools, a variety of elementary, middle, and high schools, to help not just the individuals but families with anything that may challenge them to succeed academically. So these behavioral health therapists are offering mental health services as well as connection to any variety of social services. United Way in Anchorage has done the same. There's a half a dozen of pilot schools that United Way has helped fund with private dollars to have counselors sit in the schools to provide any number of connections, whether it be legal services, whether it be food, whether it be transportation, housing, you name it. And they are seeing positive effects on the students in their attendance, in their behavior, and in their academic outcomes. It's very costly. It's hard. We have a workforce development. When they've tried to expand this Matsu up north into the Talkeetna area, it's hard to find people to come into these smaller communities. So as Senator Hoffman alluded, some of these communities are challenged. We don't have enough people to that are trained to go in these communities, is what you'll find with the Matsu Foundation. But there are efforts. They can be scaled up. It is a function of cooperation among local and state agencies. So I thought I saw Senator Olson, then I did hear the bells.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foster, as you look at the schools across the state of Alaska, I was wondering if you had looked into the idea that what kind of influence some of the mission schools had. You already mentioned Unicleet, where one of the mission schools was at and happened to be the one that I went to. And then there's also St. Mary's, which is a single-site school district that has done very well academically and has a high achievement level as well.
Senator Olson, through the chair, I have noticed that pattern, and I haven't done an independent study, but it certainly there's enough evidence on its face that the mission schools, and particularly the ones you mentioned, clearly stand out in the data that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And a hypothesis that I would be interested in testing would be whether or not that correlation sort of matches up to the correlation we're finding in the national data, where the no excuses schools are doing quite well with a wide variety of diverse student groups and helping those students grow. So I do think there are some potential sort of lessons to be learned from the success of those schools, and not just in this most recent data, but in my mind, the longevity of high performance from those schools and the value that those communities place on education, I think is another really interesting area to understand so we can figure out how to replicate it.
Last comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Has to do with there was one boarding school that I actually left out of the mix, partly because we have a representative here from that, and I wasn't sure how it bode with the rest of the results that go on. It had to do with Sheldon Jackson had a high school there, which was a mission school for many years as well, but I don't know what they were like.
Okay, thank you for the robust discussion today, and thank you, Mr. Foster, for your comprehensive presentation. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We will be hearing three bills, Senate Bill 55, Temporary Appointments to Court of Appeals, Senate Bill 65, Department of Labor Technical Ed Programs, and Senate Bill 66, Labor Standards, Safety, Workers' Compensation. If other bills come ready, we will add them to the agenda, and we will let offices know. So until then, we are adjourned.